No, I don't care. I never wanted to have anything of the sort.
Oh, of course not, you lack wit. That's not what I'm saying. Listen, these are dark and dangerous matters indeed, and the source of many a strange thing. No one who studies the Dwaelmer of Light would fool with them carelessly, the way Perrin seems to have done.
Are you telling me he follows the dark path?
I'm not, because that poor, weak, bumbling idiot obviously could do naught of the sort. I know not what Lord Perrin may be, my little Robin, but I do know that we've got to get you far, far away from him. Let's ride. We'll reach some safe spot, and then I'll see what Nevin thinks of all this.
After Jill rode away, Perrin had just enough strength to unsaddle his horse and send him out to graze. He lay down on his blankets and fell asleep, waking for a few moments at sunset, then sleeping the night away. When he woke in the morning, he rolled over, automatically reaching for Jill, and wept when he remembered that she was gone.
"How could you leave me? I loved you so much."
He forced himself to stop crying, then sat up and looked around the camp. In spite of his long sleep, he was still tired, his body aching as if he'd been in a fight. When he remembered the man who'd taken her away, he turned cold all over. Dwaelmer. What else would have shown him that peculiar vision of clouds of light and golden swords? "See what you've been doing, Lord Perrin." But he'd done nothing at all, only loved her. What did ropes of mystic light have to do with love? And she'd said that she hated him. He shook his head, refusing to cry again. At last he forced himself up and began packing his gear. He'd already placed himself in danger by staying so long. The lord who had once owned these colts might come looking for them. As he worked, he wondered which way to ride. He couldn't go back to Nedd, not for a long time, not with Benowick's wrath waiting for him. "You're twice a dolt," he told himself, "first taking another man's woman, and then losing her." Benowick would heap scorn on him for years over this, he knew. After the splendour of having had someone to love, of having had someone who had loved him, he refused to believe that Jill had never loved him. His life stretched ahead like a bleak, foggy road. It seemed to take him forever to leave the spot. He would just get some small task done, like rolling up his blankets, when something would make him think of Jill, and he would weep again. The dapple grey stayed close to him, nuzzling his shoulder or nudging him in the back as if to say that he should cheer up.
"At least you love me, don't you?" Perrin whispered. "But a horse is a wretchedly easy thing to please."
Finally, he was ready to set out, with his grey saddled, and his pack horse and the two new colts on lead ropes. He mounted, then merely sat in the saddle for a long time and stared at the place that would hold his last memories of Jill. Where to go next? The question seemed insuperable. At last, when the grey was beginning to dance in irritable restlessness under him, he turned back northwest. Not far away was the town of Lerin, where he knew a dishonest trader who would take the colts and ask no questions. All that day, he rode slowly, and the tears came and went of their own accord. Rodri might have taken a barge passage immediately if it hadn't been for the grey gnome, who came to him early on the same morning that Salamander caught up with Jill. The little creature was ecstatic, dancing around and grinning so broadly that it exposed all its long pointed teeth.
"Well, little brother, I take it you know that Jill's left Perrin?"
The gnome nodded, then pointed to the southeast.
"Is that where Jill is?"
The gnome shook its head no, then pantomimed Perrin's graceless walk.
"Oho! How far away is our dear Lord Perrin?"
The gnome shrugged and waved its hands as if to say not very far at all. Rodri debated for a long while. On the one hand, he wanted to be after Jill. On the other, his desire for revenge was like a lust. Finally, the vengeance won.
"Well and good, little brother. I'll saddle up my horse and you lead me to him."
The gnome grinned and jigged, pointing always off to the south and east. It was late in the afternoon when Rodri came to a scrappy little village, a huddle of houses at the top of a hill without even a proper wall around it. Although there was no tavern, the blacksmith's wife kept a few barrels of ale in her kitchen for thirsty travellers, but she refused to have a silver dagger in her house. She did, however, let him buy a tankard and drink it out in the muddy yard, where chickens scratched near a small sty that held a pair of half-grown pigs. The woman, a stout sort with wispy grey hair, set her hands on her hips and glared at him the whole time, as if she thought he would steal the tankard. When he was done, Rodri handed it back with an exaggerated bow.
"My thanks, fair lady. I don't suppose you get many travellers through here."
"Why do you want to know?"
"I'm looking for a friend of mine, that's all. A tall, skinny fellow with red hair and..."
"You'd best go over to the baker's, then. A fellow like that brought a tankard for me not half an hour ago, and he said he needed to buy bread."
"Oh, indeed. He didn't have a lass with him, did he?"
"He didn't. Just a couple of extra horses. Too many horses, if you ask me. Didn't like the look of him, I didn't."
Following her directions, Rodri hurried along the twisting street. When he reached the house with the big beehive clay ovens in the front yard, he saw Perrin's dapple grey, his pack horse, and a pair of colts tied up nearby. He laughed aloud, just a quick snatch of a berserker's chuckle, and thanked Great Bell in his heart. As he tied up his horse, he could see Perrin through the open door, handing over some coppers to a fellow in a cloth apron. Rodri strode in. His hands full of loaves, Perrin turned and yelped, a satisfying gulp of pure terror.
"You bastard!" Rodri snarled. "Where's my wife?"
Oh, well, I don't know."
His face pale, the baker began edging for the door. Rodri ignored him and went for Perrin. He grabbed him by the shirt and slammed him against the stone wall so hard that Perrin dropped the bread. Rodri kicked it out of the way and slammed him again.
"Where's Jill?"
"I don't know."
Perrin was gasping for breath.
"She left me, I swear it. She left me on the road."
"I know that, dolt. Where?"
When Perrin smirked at him, Rodri hit him in the stomach. He doubled over, choking, but Rodri straightened him up and hit him again.
"Where did she leave you?"
Half blind from tears in his eyes, Perrin raised his head. Rodri slapped him across the face.
"I know you're going to kill me," Perrin gasped. "Not going to tell you one rotten thing."
Rodri saw no reason to admit that he'd sworn a vow to leave him alive. He grabbed him by the shoulders, hauled him forward, and slammed him into the stone again.
"Where is she? If you tell me, you live."
"I don't know, by the gods."
Rodri was about to hit him in the stomach a second time when he heard noises behind him. He glanced over his shoulder and saw the white-faced baker, flanked by the blacksmith carrying an iron bar, and two other men with threshing flails at the ready.
"Now, what's all this, Silver Dagger? You can't ride in and just murder someone."
"I'm not going to murder anyone. This whoreson pisspot little bastard stole my wife away, and now he won't tell me where she is."
The four villagers considered, glancing at one another and at the sword at Rodri's side. Even though the four of them would have had more than a good chance against one man, no matter how skilled with a sword, it seemed they were the prudent sort.
"Ah, well," the blacksmith said, "then it's no affair of ours if he's been meddling with your woman."
"Just get him out of my house," the baker moaned.
"Gladly. Rats don't belong in a granary."
Rodri twisted Perrin's right arm behind his back and shoved him out of the bakery. When his victim struggled, Rodri swung him sideways and knocked him against the wall of the next house so hard that he screamed.
"Where's Jill?"
"I don't know, and I wouldn't tell you if I did."
Rodri hit him in the stomach so hard he vomited, falling to his knees. When he was done, Rodri hauled him up, twisted his arm again, and then marched him round the bakery to a big stone shed. He threw him face forward against the wall, peeled him off, and turned him round, then shoved him back again. By then, Perrin could barely stand up.
"For the last time, where is she?"
Gasping, Perrin wiped feebly at the blood pouring from his nose and from a cut over his eye. Rodri unbuckled his sword belt and let it drop.
"Come on, coward. Draw on me if you dare."
Perrin merely gasped and snivelled. Rodri's stomach tightened in sheer contempt.
"You base-born little half-gelded swine."
Rodri jumped him, grabbed him with one hand and began hitting him as hard as he could with the other. The pleasure of beating Perrin filled his entire mind, just as when a sheet of flame races through the forest and sweeps everything before it. Suddenly, he remembered the holy vow he'd sworn to Benwick. He let Perrin go and leaned him back against the wall. Fortunately, the Lord was still breathing. He looked at Rodri for a moment with glazed eyes, one of which was already swelling shut, tried to speak, gasped, then crumpled, sliding slowly down the wall to the ground. Rodri gave him one last kick and turned to find the four villagers standing as solemnly as judges and three small boys, wide-eyed with excitement. Nearby was the grey gnome, clapping its hands and grinning while it did a little victory dance. Rodri retrieved his sword belt and buckled it on while he caught his breath.
There. I didn't murder him, did I?
They all shook their heads in agreement.
I thought silver daggers didn't have wives, said one of the boys.
I did. Let me tell you summat. If ever you find another silver dagger with a wife, then you keep your blasted little paws off her.
The lads looked at Perrin, then nodded again. When Rodri walked toward them, they all parted to give him plenty of room and fell in behind him like an honour guard while he fetched his horse. He mounted and rode out, heading northwest to return to the river. His hands were bloody, bruised and aching, but he'd never enjoyed a pain more in his life. As soon as he was out of sight of the village, the gnome appeared on his saddle peak.
That was a splendid bit of fun, wasn't it, little brother?
With an evil grin, the gnome nodded a yes.
Now, am I going the right way? Is Jill heading for the river?
Again it nodded yes.
Is she going to care more?
It waggled its hands and shrugged its shoulders to show that it didn't truly know. It occurred to Rodri that place names would mean nothing at all to the wild folk.
Well, if she's on the river, I'll catch her up sure enough. My thanks, little brother. You'd best get back to Jill and keep an eye on her.
Out of compassion on the one hand and a sense of having seen justice done on the other, the blacksmith and the baker picked Perrin up and carried him into the baker's cowshed, where they laid him down on a heap of straw. Perrin could barely see them out of his swollen eyes. His chest ached so badly that he was sure Rodri had broken a couple of his ribs, and his lower lip was split and bleeding. The baker's wife brought out a bowl of water, gave him a drink, then washed his face for him.
"Didn't like the look of that silver dagger, I didn't. Here, did you really take his wife?"
Perrin mumbled out a sound that passed for,
"I did."
"Ha! I don't see why any lass would take you over him. But then lasses is flighty sometimes. Ah, well, you can stay here for a day or two, lad, if you'll give me a couple of coppers for horse feed."
Perrin nodded a yes, then fainted. Irritated to the point of rage, Nevin sat in his chamber and glared at Salamander's image as it danced over the glowing coals in the charcoal brazier. The Girthin seemed honestly bewildered.
"But I couldn't leave Jill with that lout."
"Of course not, you dolt. That isn't the point. The point is this Perrin himself. You've left behind a gravely ill man."
"Who repeatedly raped my brother's woman."
"I know that, and I'm furious about it, but what I'm trying to tell you is that he's deathly ill."
"And if he dies, what loss will it be?"
"Hold your tongue, you chattering elf!"
Salamander's image shrank back and turned pale. Nevin took a deep breath and controlled himself.
"Now listen, Ibani. If Perrin continues on this way, he's going to pour out his life force until there's precious little left. Then he'll get some illness, most likely a consumption of the lungs, and die, just as you've guessed. But in the meantime, he'll also be harming other women because he can't help himself. He's like a man with a plague, spreading foul humours and contagion over the countryside, even though he doesn't wish another soul harm. Now do you see?"
"I do at that, and my apologies."
Salamander did look sincerely chastened.
"But what could I have done? Ensorcelled him, roped him like one of his horses and dragged him along with us. Jill can't bear the sight of him, and in her state..."
"Well, true enough. Let me think. The nearest Dwayoma worker is Lithin of Cantrey. He can possibly find our Perrin and corral him. Truly, your first concern has to be Jill."
form a link with her aura, and then, slowly, mind you, draw off some of that excess magnetism. The process should take some days, because you'll have to absorb it yourself. Or here, expend it. Do some of your wretched little tricks with it. It might amuse her.
I doubt me if any show of Dwaelmer will do more than terrify her now.
Maybe so. Ah, ye gods! What a nasty mess you've dropped in our laps.
So they have. Here, one more strange thing about Perrin. When I first saw him, I opened up my sight and looked into his soul. I was thinking perhaps that he was some man linked to Jill by his weird or such like.
Was he?
I couldn't tell you that. I couldn't read his soul. All at once, Salamander looked rueful. Truly, I must have let my rage, wrath, and righteousness override my reason. I kept seeing him as some kind of half-human monster, not as a man at all.
Valandario's been telling you, and I have been telling you, that Dwaelmer demands that a man keep his feelings under control. Do you see now what we mean, ye gods?
You have my true and humble apologies, O Master. Here, since I've seen Perrin, I can scry him out whenever you or Lithen need my aid.
And doubtless we will. He's got to be caught.
True enough. I wasn't thinking. I was just seeing our Jill so, well, so broken and so shamed. It ached my heart.
It aches mine, too.
Nevin realized then that part of his anger at Salamander was only a spillover from his rage at what had happened.
I only wish I could come join you. If you're riding south, maybe I will. It depends on how things go here.
Where are you, by the by? Nevin managed a laugh.
My turn for the apologies. I'm in the Gwerbret's Dun in Aberwyn.
Ye gods! I'm surprised Rhys will let you cross his threshold.
Oh, he bears me no particular ill will. Lady Levian asked me to come with her and pretend to be a legal counsellor. She's going to try one last time to get Rhys to recall Rodri.
No doubt the Hells will melt first.
No doubt. On the other hand, Rhys loves Aberwyn, and he might do what's best for her in the end.
When Salamander looked profoundly sceptical, Nevin sighed in agreement. Being stubborn was a crucial part of a noble-born man's honour, and Rhys, like all Maelwyths, would never betray his. After finishing his talk with Salamander, Nevin went to the open window and leaned on the sill to look out. From his chamber, high up in the brock, he could see the gardens, a long reach of lawn lit with 100 tiny oil lamps, where the ladies of the court were having an evening entertainment. Minstrels played, and the noble-born danced among the flickering lights. He could hear them laughing, half out of breath as they circled round, stamping and slapping their feet in time to the harps and wooden flutes.
Ah, my poor Jill, he thought. Will you ever be as happy as they again?
His anger came close to choking him, a cold fury with Perrin, with Rhys, stubborn men who insisted on having what they wanted, no matter what they cost to anyone else. Rhys was the worse, he decided, because his refusal to recall his brother could plunge Eldith into open war. And then all those noble lords below would ride in a circling dance of death, this entertainment long forgotten. He pulled the shutters closed so hard that they banged like thunder in the chamber, and turned away to pace back and forth. Finally, he shook the mood away, and turned to the brazier again. When he thought of Rodri, the image appeared in an instant. He was standing, his back to the wall, in a crowded tavern, and watching a dice game while he sipped from a tankard. At times, when Rodri was in a particular melancholy mood, Nevin could reach his mind and send him thoughts, but tonight he was preoccupied, and oddly enough, not at all unhappy. At times he smiled to himself, as if remembering a triumph.
Most odd, Nevin thought. Why isn't he brooding over Jill?
When someone knocked on his door, he cancelled the vision. Lady Levian came in, her plaid cloak caught at the shoulder with a ring brooch set with rubies winking in the candlelight.
Have you had enough of the dancing, my lady?
More than enough, but I came to see you for another reason. A speeded courier just rode in from Dun Deveri.
She handed him a piece of parchment, tightly rolled from its long sojourn inside a message tube.
This is supposedly for my eyes alone, but I doubt if Blaine would mind you reading it.
After the long ritual salutations, the letter itself was brief.
I am in Dundevery in attendance upon the king. He tells me only that he's most interested in talking with a certain silver dagger known to you. Would the dragon roar if our liege usurped one of his privileges? By the by, Lord Talith seems to have found a friend in Savile of Camanwain. Blaine. Gwerbret Kimpeckle.
Hmph!
Nevin snorted.
Blaine isn't much of a man at subterfuge.
Rhys would have understood that message in an instant if he'd read it.
Levian took the letter back and dropped it into the glowing charcoal. The smell of burning leather drifted into the room, and Nevin hurried to open the shutters.
The news about Savile of Camanwain's troubling. I do not like the idea of Talith's finding another Gwerbret to plead his case with our liege.
No more do I. Ye gods, this is all getting vexed.
Do you think Rhys would rebel if the king overrode his decree of exile?
Not on his own, but he might be persuaded by men who think they have a chance at the Ran if he died childless.
Just so. They try to push him into it anyway. On the other hand, if the king does intervene, then Rhys could stop my nagging tongue without losing any face.
True enough. He could bluster about the decree all he wanted in front of the other lords, but accept it privately.
So I hope. Well, we don't even know if the king truly plans to recall Rodri.
She looked at the twisted sheet of parchment ash in the brazier, then picked up the poker and knocked it into dust.
Let us hope that Blaine sends us more news soon.
Rodri had no trouble buying passage on a barge that was making the run down to Lugcan. His horse shared the stern with the barge mules that would pull the boat upriver again. He had a place to sleep in the bow with the four crewmen, who spoke to him as little as possible. The rest of the barge's 100 feet were laden with rough-shaped iron ingots from the smelters of Ladatin up in the high mountains. Although the barge rode low in the water, the river current was smooth and steady, and for 3 days they glided south, while Rodri amused himself by watching the countryside go by. Once the hills were behind them, the grassy meadows and rich grain fields of Gwaintair province spread out, green and gold in the late summer sun, flat and seemingly endless. On the fourth day, they crossed the border into Deveri proper, though Rodri didn't see much change in the countryside to mark it. Toward noon, the bargemaster told him that they'd make Lugcan that night.
"It's the end of our run, Silver Dagger, but I'll wager you can find another barge going down into Dundevery."
"Splendid. This is the cursed sight faster than riding, and I've got to reach Caermore as soon as ever I can."
The bargemaster scratched his beard thoughtfully.
"Don't know much about the river traffic south out of the King's City, but I'll wager there's some."
He shrugged his massive shoulders.
"Well, whether there is or not, you'll be only about a week's ride from Caermore then."
By late afternoon, Rodri saw the first sign that they were coming close to the city. At first he thought he was seeing clouds on the southern horizon, but the steersman enlightened him. A dark pall of smoke hung in the air, smoke from the charcoal ovens, smoke from the charcoal itself as it fed the forges to turn rough iron into Lugcan steel. By the time they turned into the docks just outside the walled city, his linen shirt was flecked with soot. The docks themselves and the warehouses just beyond were grimy grey. As he rode through the gate in the soot-blackened city walls, Rodri was thinking that he'd be very glad to leave Lugcan behind. Yet it was a rich city under the soot. As he searched for a tavern poor enough to take in a silver dagger, Rodri passed fine houses, some of them as tall as a poor lord's broch, with carved plaques over the doors proclaiming the name of one great merchant clan or another. There were temples all over the city too, some to obscure gods usually relegated to a tiny shrine in the corner of a temple of Bel. Some, like the great temple of Bel itself, as large as Dunn's, with gardens and outbuildings of their own. Until he finally found the poor section of town, down by the river on the southern bank, he saw very few beggars, and even among the wooden huts of the longshoremen and charcoal burners, he saw almost no one in rags, and not a child who looked in danger of starving. He found a shabby tavern whose owner agreed to let him sleep in the hayloft of the stable out back for a couple of coppers. After he stabled his horse, he went back in and got the best dinner the place offered, mutton stew lenced with grease and served with stale bread to sop up the gravy. He took it to a table where he could keep his back to the wall and looked over the other patrons while he ate. Most of them looked like honest working men, gathered there to have a tankard while they chewed over the local gossip, but one of them might have been a traveller like himself. A tall fellow, with straight dark hair and skin coloured like a walnut shell that bespoke some Bardic blood in his veins. Once or twice, Rodri caught the fellow looking at him curiously, and when he'd finished eating, the fellow strolled over to him with a tankard in his hand.
"Have you come from the north, Silver Dagger?"
"I have at that. Why?"
"That's the way I'm heading. I was wondering what the roads are like up in Gwentaer."
"Now that I can't tell you, because I came down on a barge."
"A good way to travel when you're coming down river, but not so good going up. Well, my thanks anyway."
Yet he lingered for a moment, as if wondering about something, then finally sat down.
"You know, a Silver Dagger did me a favour once a while back, and I wouldn't mind returning it to a fellow member of his band."
He dropped his voice to a murmur.
"You look like you hail from Eldith."
"I do."
"You wouldn't be Rodri of Aberwyn, would you?"
"I am. Here, where did you hear my name?"
"Oh, it's all over the south. That's what I mean about returning a favour. Let me give you a tip, like. It seems that every misbegotten Gwerbret has riders out looking for you. I'd head west if I were you."
"What? By the black ass of the Lord of Hell, what are they looking for me for?"
The fellow leaned closer.
"There's been a charge laid against you by a Tyrann Aegwic up in Caergonny. He claims you took his brother's head in battle."
Instantly, Rodri understood, or thought he did. No doubt Greymon had put the blame on him in order to reach a settlement in the peace treaty. After all, who would believe a Silver Dagger's word against that of a lord?
"Ye gods, I did no such thing."
"It's of no matter to me, but like I say, you'd best be careful which way you ride."
"You have my thanks from the bottom of my heart."
All that evening, Rodri kept one eye on the tavern door. If that charge stood up in Gwerbretel Court, he would be beheaded as the holy laws demanded. Fortunately, his years on the long road had taught him many a thing about avoiding trouble. He could no longer ride the barges south, not when they could be called to the bank at any point by the king's guard and searched. He would have to slip south on back roads and, of course, lie about his name. Caermore itself was big enough so that he'd be able to stay unknown for at least a day or two. Once he found Jill, he'd have a witness on his side.
"Besides," he reminded himself, "Nevin's there too. Even a Gwerbret would listen when the old man spoke."
In the morning, he rode out the east gate to plant a false trail. Much later, when it was too late, he realized that Tyrann Benwick would never have been party to such a falsehood.
"Someone worked you over good and proper, lad," said Gwell the leech. "Who was it?"
Oh, well, Perrin mumbled. "A Silver Dagger."
"Indeed? Well, it's a foolish man who earns a Silver Dagger's wrath."
I know that now."
In the polished mirror hanging on the wall of the leech's shop, Perrin could see his face, still blue, green and swollen.
"You should have had this broken tooth out long before this,"
Gwell said.
"True spoken, but I couldn't ride until a couple of days ago. He broke some of my ribs, too."
"I see. Well, you give Silver Daggers a wide berth after this."
"You have my sworn word on that."
Having the tooth pulled was far more painful than having it broken, since it took much longer, and the only painkiller the leech could offer him was a goblet of strong mead. It was some hours before Perrin could leave the leech's shop and stagger back to his inn on the outskirts of Lerin. He flopped down on the bed in his chamber and stared miserably at the ceiling while his mind circled endlessly round and round like a donkey tied to a mill wheel. What was he going to do? The thought of returning to Caergonny to face his uncle's scorn made him feel physically sick to his stomach. And there was Jill. It seemed as the days went by that he loved her more than ever, that he'd never appreciated what he had until he'd lost it. Thinking that most men were no different about those they loved was no consolation. If only he could talk to her, beg her to let him explain, tell her how much he loved her. He was sure she would listen, if only he could get her alone. If only he could get her away from that fellow with the terrifying stare and the even more terrifying Dwayoma. If only. He didn't even know which way they'd gone. Or could he find her? In his muddled state, half mad with pain and the aftermath of the leech's mead, he found himself thinking of her as his heart's true home, and with the thought came the pull, the sharp tug at his mind that had always shown him the way to other homes. Slowly, minding his aching jaw, he sat up on the bed and went very still. Truly, he could feel it. South. She'd gone south. He wept, but this time in rising hope that he could track her down, follow her along until he had a chance alone with her, and somehow, oh, by great Charon himself, steal her back again.
"Now this is passing strange," Salamander announced. "Rodri's still heading south, but by the ears of Epona's steed, why is he taking every rotten cowpath and village lane instead of riding on the king's good roads?"
Jill turned to look at him. They were sitting on the bow of a river barge, and Salamander was using the foaming, sun-flecked waters as a focus for scrying. Since she still was seeing with power, the water seemed like solid, carved silver, but she could remind herself now that what she was seeing was only illusionary. She refused to believe that she was seeing a hidden reality, no matter how often Salamander insisted on it.
"Does he seem to be looking for a hire?"
"Not in the least, and I've been watching him for 2 days now. It seems that he knows where he's going, but he's being cursed careful on the way." With an irritable toss of his head, he looked away from the river. "Well, I'll spy out the esteemed brother again later. How are you feeling this morn?"
"A lot better. At least things are holding still most of the time."
"Good. Then my unpracticed cure is actually working.
You have my heartfelt thanks, truly."
For a while she idly watched the southern horizon, where Lucan's smoke hung like a tiny cloud. She wished that she could simply forget about Perrin, that Salamander had some magic that would wipe her mind clean of his memory, but she knew that the shame she felt would nag at her for years. She felt as unclean as a priestess who'd broken her vows, and was somehow to blame, too, for her abduction. If only she'd told Rodri, or called to Nevin earlier, or... The if-onlys ran on and on.
"From the hirith in your eyes," Salamander said abruptly, "I think me you're brooding again." "Oh, how can I not brood? It's all well and good to chase after Rodri, but I imagine he'll only curse me to my face when we find him."
"Why? You are no more at fault than one of the horses Perrin stole." She merely shook her head to keep tears away.
"Now here, Jill, my turtle dove. Your mind's back. You can think again. Let me tell you summat. I've been thinking about our horse-stealing lord, and I've talked with Nevin, too. There's summat cursed peculiar about that lad. He has what you might call a wound of the soul, the way he pours out his life at will."
"But I'm the one who fell right into his wretched arms. Ah, ye gods! I never dreamt that I was as weak-willed as some slut of a tavern lass."
Salamander growled under his breath.
"Haven't you listened to one blasted word I said? It's not a question of weak will. You were ensorcelled, Dwayomer bound, and Dwayomer muddled. Once his life force swept over you, you had no will of your own, only his will. All his lust ran to you like water through a ditch."
For a moment she wanted to vomit, as she remembered how it felt to have him smile at her in his particular way.
"Why do you call it a wound?" she said.
"Because it's going to kill him sooner or later."
"Good. I only wish I could be there to watch."
"And no one expects you to feel differently, my delicate little lass. But can't you see, Jill? You're as blameless as if he'd tied you down and raped you by force."
"Ah, ye gods, and that's what I hate most. I felt so beastly helpless."
"You were helpless."
"Oh, true enough. It's a cursed hard thing to admit."
Boyles need lancing, on the other hand. When she threw a fake punch his way, he smiled. Truly, you're coming back to your old self. But don't you see the curious thing? Given that Perrin has no true Dweomer, then where by all the hells does this power come from? What gave him the wound?
As much as I hate to talk about the worm-rotted bastard, I'll admit the question's of some interest.
Of great interest, especially to Nevin. Unfortunately, at the moment, there is no answer.
Well, if anyone can find it, it's Nevin.
Precisely. Especially once he gets his hands on him.
Is he planning on hunting Perrin down?
Not truly. I've been waiting to tell you this until you were stronger, but I think you can bear it now. Perrin's been following us. She felt the blood drain from her face. Salamander caught her hand and held it between both of his. You're in no danger now, none at all.
Not now, maybe. But what about when we're out on the roads again, following Rodri?
By then, Perrin will be on his way to Eldith under armed guard. Here, there's a Dweomer man at court named Lord Maddock. He'll have Perrin arrested as soon as he enters the city, then send him to Nevin. From what you've told me, that rambling scribe in our lordling's saddlebags is more than enough reason for the king's wardens to take him under arrest.
So, we're going to Dundeverry?
We are, and we may not have to leave it either. Do you know Rodri's cousin, Blaine of Quimpeckle?
I do.
The good Gwerbret's at court at the moment. Nevin wants us to speak with him. It seems that the king sent out the word that he wants to see Rodri. Apparently, the various Gwerbrets are keeping watch for him, and when they find him, they'll send him straight to Dundeverry.
The king? What?
I don't know, but I think me we can guess. The king knows Rhys won't be getting any more heirs for Aberwyn.
Recall?
Just that. So soon enough, Jill, you'll be having a splendid wedding.
Oh, will I now? You sound like a village idiot. Think. They're never going to let the heir to the most important ran in Eldith marry a Silver Daggers bastard. The best I could hope for is being his wretched mistress again, living in his court and hating his wife. Well, if he even wants me any more. What do you think this is? One of your tales?
I have the distinct and revolting feeling that I was thinking just that. Jill, please forgive me. She merely shrugged and watched the farmland gliding by. A herd of white cattle with rusty red ears were drinking from the river, watched over by a lad and two dogs. "Do you forgive me?" he said at last.
"I do. And my apologies, too. I'm all to pieces still."
"So you are. After you've baited our trap for Perrin, you could just ride away without seeing Rodri, if you wanted."
"Never. Maybe he'll curse me to my face. But I want to tell him that I always loved him."
Salamander started to speak, but she covered her face with her hands and wept. The king's palace in Dundeverry was enormous, 6 broch towers joined by a sprawling complex of half brochs, surrounded by outbuildings and protected by a double ring of curtain walls. As an honoured guest, Blaine, Gwerbret Quimpeckle, had a luxurious suite high up in one of the outer towers, so that he had a good view of the gardens that lay between the pair of walls. In his reception chamber were 4 chairs with cushions of purple bardic velvet, as well as a table and a hearth of its own. Although Blaine cared little for such luxuries as things in themselves, he appreciated them as marks of the king's favour. Besides, his wife, Canifa, was accompanying him on this trip, and he liked to see her surrounded by comfort. A tall woman with dark hair and doe-like brown eyes, Canifa was as calm as he was excitable. Although their marriage had been of the usual arranged sort, Blaine privately considered that he'd been exceptionally lucky in his wife. At moments, he could even admit to her that he loved her. This particular morning, Canifa had been called to wait upon the Queen in Her Majesty's private chamber, a signal honour, but one that had come her way before. Blaine perched on the windowsill in their bedchamber and watched as she dressed with special care. After one of her serving women laid out several dresses on the bed, she sent the lass away and studied the choices, finally picking a modest one of dove grey bardex silk, a colour that showed off the reds and whites of her husband's clan's plaid to advantage. I think Werbred Savile's wife is going to be attending the Queen this morning as well, she remarked. I assume that my lord would like me to keep my ears open.
Your lord would like naught better, truly. What's the wife like, anyway? Khaneefa considered before answering.
A weasel, but a lovely one. I gather that they're well suited.
In weaselhood, perhaps. No one would call Savile lovely. Cursed if I know why he's sticking his oar in this particular stream. Camin Wain's a long way from Belglaith. What use can Talith possibly be to him?
I believe they've got bloodkin in common. But still, the point's well taken, my lord. I shall see if I can cultivate the lovely Lady Brefa. She paused for a quick smile. But if I'm going to sacrifice myself this way, I shall expect a handsome present from our Rodri when he's recalled.
Some of the finest Bardic silver, no doubt. I'll make sure he honours you properly. Well, if we can get him recalled anyway.
While Khaneefa was off with the Queen, Blaine had a guest of his own, a powerful man who was worth another sort of cultivation. He had his page fetch a silver flagon of mead and two glass goblets, then sent the lad away. The Gwerbret filled the glasses with his own hands and gave one to his guest, who took an appreciative sip. The recently ennobled Lord Madoc, third equerry to the king, was a slender man of about 40, with neatly trimmed blonde hair, barely touched with grey, and humorous blue eyes. He was also, or so it was said, Nevin's nephew.
Indeed, Blaine thought to himself, but I'll wager he's another sorcerer, nephew or not.
Since he'd been a successful horse breeder in Cantre province before his recent court appointment, Madoc certainly did his job well, and he had a plain yet decent sort of manners that allowed him to fit into the court as smoothly as any minor lord, if not more so. Yet every now and then, there was something about the way he looked or smiled that implied that the power and pomp of the court failed to impress him.
"My thanks for the invitation to visit you, Your Grace," Madoc said. "To what do I owe the honour?"
"Simple hospitality, in a way. I know your uncle well."
"Of course. I had a letter from him recently. He's quite well."
"Splendid. Is he still in Eldith?"
"He is, Your Grace. Lovian, Tyrin Dun Gwerbin, has taken him into her service."
"I'll just wager," Blaine thought to himself. "More like he's taken her into his, whether she knows it or not." "That's good news," he said aloud. "Our Nevin's getting a bit old to travel the roads with a mule."
"His health's a marvel, isn't it, Your Grace? But then my mother is still alive and sharp as a sword, and her past 70.
"Let's hope the gods grant that you inherit their stamina, then." Blaine gave him a friendly grin. "Levian's kin to me, of course, my mother's sister."
"So I'd heard, Your Grace. But then, there's been quite a bit of talk of late of your cousin Rodri."
"No doubt. Trying to keep a secret at court is generally a waste of time. The gossip started buzzing, I'll wager, the moment our liege summoned me here."
"A bit sooner than that, truly."
Madoc shook his head in mock sadness.
"The first rumours, Your Grace, were that the king might summon you."
"I'll wager you know, then, that our liege is looking for my scapegrace cousin."
"I do, at that. And the gossip is that the king means to override his sentence of exile."
"Well, I can't really tell you if that's true or not. I haven't been sworn to any secrets, mind. Our liege hasn't told me, that's all. I guess that he's not sure yet."
"Most like, Your Grace. Overriding a Gwerbret decree is not to be done lightly."
"Just so."
Blaine paused for a long swallow of mead.
"But curse it all, the king can't do one thing or the other until Rodri's been found."
"Still no news, Your Grace?"
"Not a shred. By every god and his wife, what's wrong with those packs of idiots that the Gwerbrets call riders? The kingdom's big, sure enough, but they should have found one silver dagger by now."
"So you'd think, Your Grace."
For the briefest of moments, Madoc looked troubled.
"I truly thought they would have tracked him down quite quickly."
"So did I."
Here was the crux, and Blaine paused briefly.
"In fact, I was wondering if perhaps you'd help with the hunt."
"Me, Your Grace? Well, I'd certainly do anything that my duties here allow, but I'm not sure what I could do."
I'm not truly sure either, but I suspect a man known as Nevin's nephew might see things hidden from others.
Madoc blinked twice, then smiled. Ah, Your Grace, you know about the old man's Dwayoma, then?
I do. He went out of his way to let me know. Last summer it was. He seemed to find it strangely easy to see things a long way away.
So he can, Your Grace. Let me be blunt. If I could scry Rodri out, I would, but I've never seen him in the flesh, and so I can't.
Blaine had a gulp of mead to hide his surprise. He'd been expecting a lot of fencing before Madoc admitted the truth, but here the man had just spat it out.
I see, Blaine said at last. Pity.
It is. I may be able to get you news some other way. His Grace is right. Things are growing worrisome. Rodri really should have been found by now.
Just so. Do you know what my worst fear is? That some of the men whose clans stand to inherit Aberwyn when Rhys dies may have taken steps to have the legitimate heir removed.
Ye gods, would they stoop so low?
Aberwyn is one of the richest rands in the kingdom, and it's going to grow richer. Just a year ago the king gave the city a more liberal charter. One of the terms was that Aberwyn would have a share in the royal monopoly on trade with Bardic.
Madoc nodded, a grim little smile twisting his mouth. His Grace's point is well taken. Well and good, then. If His Grace will excuse me for a moment.
Of course.
Blaine was expecting Madoc to leave the chamber, but instead he went to the window and looked up at the sky, where white clouds billowed and tore on the edge of a summer storm. He stood there, while Blaine downed two more goblets of mead, and wondered what the man was doing. Finally, he turned back, looking troubled. Rodri's almost to Drawthbury, and he seems to be travelling south. He's bought himself a second horse to make speed. It would appear that he's heading for Caermore.
I wonder what they want in Caermore.
They, Your Grace.
Well, isn't Jill with him?
My apologies, Your Grace. I forgot you wouldn't know. He and Jill were separated by an unfortunate turn of events. She's following along after him with a friend, a Girthin who gallantly offered to escort her. The last I heard, they were coming to Dundevery to beg your aid.
Which they'll have, of course.
Blaine considered for a moment.
Have you ever met my cousin or his woman?
I've not, Your Grace.
They match each other like a pair of fine boots. If Rodri's going to inherit Aberwyn, I'd rather see Jill beside him than the noble-born sheep his mother would pick for him.
But isn't she common-born?
She is, but details like that have been arranged away before. I'll have to think on it.
Several hours later, it occurred to Blaine that he implicitly believed what Madoc had told him.
I've seen Dwayoma before, he reminded himself, but still he shuddered.
What had Madoc been reading in the cloudy sky? Thanks to the rain, the bargemen had hung canvas across the bow of the barge, an imperfect shelter, but better than none at all. Jill wrapped her cloak around her tightly and watched Salamander staring at the foaming water rushing by. Every now and then, his mouth would frame a silent word or two. By then, her sight was nearly back to normal. The water was merely water. Salamander no longer changed colour to reflect what he was feeling. There was only a certain vividness to colours, a certain urgency to patterns of line and shape, to remind her of the splendours she had seen when she'd been bathed in forbidden power. With a grudging self-mockery, she had to admit that in a way she was sorry to lose that dangerous beauty. Finally, Salamander turned to her to whisper. I've just been talking with Lord Madoc. He wanted to know where I'd last scried Rodri out, so he could tell Blaine. Not that it'll do much good, truly. A speeded courier still couldn't catch up with him.
True enough, but the courier could tell the Gwerbret in Caermore to watch out for him.
If he stays in Caermore.
Jill raised her hands in a gesture of frustration. She was wishing that she hadn't taught Rodri the ways of the long road so well. For days now, he'd slipped through the net of riders looking for him like a fox through a hedgerow.
Well, we'll be in Dundevery tomorrow, Salamander said,
and we can talk with Blaine directly.
Good. You know, in spite of everything, I'm really looking forward to seeing the King's City. I've wandered over this kingdom since I was 8 years old, but I've never been there. There aren't any hires for silver daggers in the King's own lands.
All at once, the grey gnome popped into being, not a foot away from her. When she held out her hands to it, it hesitated, screwing up its face at her.
"Oh, here, little one. What have I done to make you so angry with me?"
It held out for only a moment longer, then threw itself into her arms. She hugged it tight.
"I'm so glad you've forgiven me. I've missed you."
Smiling, it reached up to pat her cheek.
"We'll be back with Rodri soon, with any luck. Have you visited him? Is he well?"
It nodded yes to both questions, snuggling against her like a cat.
"I wish I knew where he was going."
The gnome looked up and pointed at her.
"He's following me."
Again it nodded yes, but so indifferently that she wasn't sure if it had truly understood. Salamander had been watching all of this closely. "Interesting and twice interesting," he pronounced. "But I wonder what it means." Although the leech advised Perrin to stay in Lerin for at least 5 days to recover from his beating, he left town as soon as he could possibly ride. Once he'd tuned his mind to Jill, her presence ached him like another wound, drawing him after her. Yet his longing was tempered with fear of the strange fellow with the moonbeam-pale hair who had taken her away. As he thought things over, he wondered if he had somehow dreamt that terrifying scene where he'd seen clouds of coloured light and glowing swords. Every time he tried to convince himself that he'd been dreaming, he came up against the inescapable fact that Jill was gone. He simply refused to admit that she ever would have left him of her own free will. There had to be another man involved, and him a powerful one. Although most people in the kingdom dismissed tales of Dwayoma, Perrin had always instinctively believed they were true. That indeed there was a thing called Dwayoma, and that with it, men could work marvels. Now, to his very cold comfort, he'd been proven right. His one consolation in all this was that if he didn't have Jill, neither did Rodri. 3 days' ride brought him to Gathermere, a large, prosperous town behind a double ring of stone walls. Although he would have preferred to avoid the town entirely, he was too low on provisions. Normally he hated being in towns, packed in with a lot of smelly, sweaty people, bound up in their petty human concerns like pigs in a sty. But that night he found it a certain comfort to sit in the tavern room of a shabby inn with human beings around him to distract him from his constant, aching longing for Jill. Out in the forest he would have missed her constantly. There he could drink down strong ale and try to forget her. When the tavernman came by to ask him if he'd be spending the night, on impulse he said that he would.
"But, I don't truly want to share a chamber with someone. Could I, sleep out in the hayloft?"
"No reason why not. Plenty of room out there."
Perrin got himself another tankard of ale and found a seat in an out-of-the-way corner. Although he was planning on simply drinking himself so blind that he'd be unable to think, the tavern lass changed his mind. She was a round-faced little thing, with dark hair and knowing dark eyes, and a smile that promised a few interesting hours, if not much more. Perrin decided that she was a much better way to distract himself from thoughts of Jill than a hangover would be. He chatted with her for a few minutes, asked her name, which was Aletha, and found, as he'd expected, that she was utterly cold to him. When she turned to go, he gave her one of his smiles. Although he'd never understood what he was doing, the smile worked as it always did. Aletha stared at him, her lips half parted, her eyes stunned as she lingered beside him. When he smiled again, she cast a nervous glance at the tavernman, then came much closer.
"And is the innkeep going to mind if you talk a bit with a customer?"
"Oh, he won't. As long as it's just talk."
"What are you, then? His daughter?"
"Huh. Far from it."
"Indeed?"
Perrin paused for another longing smile.
"So, part of your hire is keeping his bed warm."
Aletha blushed, but she moved closer still, until her full breasts were brushing his arm. He smiled yet again, and was rewarded by seeing her eyes go all dreamy as she smiled in return. When Perrin saw that the tavernman was engrossed in conversation with a pair of merchants, he risked laying his hand on her cheek.
"He doesn't look like much of a man to me. A lass like you could use a little better company of a night. I'm sleeping out in the hayloft, you see. Out of, out of the way. I could go out there right now."
"I could follow in a bit, but I can't stay long," she giggled in an oddly drunken way. "But then, it won't take long."
With another giggle, Eleitha hurried away to the kitchen. Perrin lingered long enough to finish his ale and allay the tavernman's suspicions, then slipped out to the hayloft. Since the lass had something to hide, he didn't take a candle lantern. He found his gear in his horse's stall, hauled it up the ladder, and stumbled around in the dark until he got the blankets laid out and his boots off. As he sat waiting in the mounded hay, he began to wonder why he was even bothering with this seduction. No woman would ever match his Jill. The thought of her brought him close to tears, but in a few minutes he was distracted by the sound of a lather climbing the ladder. He went to meet her and kissed her before she got any thoughts of changing her mind.
"Oh, ye gods!"
She sounded honestly troubled.
"I hardly know what's wrong with me, running after you like this."
"Nought's wrong. Come lie down with me and I'll show you why you did."
Meekly she let him take her to his blankets. At first she was shy in his arms, but with every kiss he gave her, he could feel not only a growing sexual tension, but a power, a strange dark feeling that rose from deep within and flooded him until it was almost more demanding than the sexual force. As the power grew, she responded to it, whimpering in his arms at every caress. Finally, she caught his hand.
"I don't have time to take my dress off. Just pull it up and now, please."
As soon as they were finished, she gave him one last kiss and a sincere confession that she wished she could stay all night, then hurry back to her jealous man. By then, Perrin was so exhausted that he was glad she was gone. He fell onto his blankets and stared up into a strange light-shot darkness that revolved slowly around him. When he tried to close his eyes, the feeling of motion persisted, so strong that he wanted to vomit. He opened his eyes in a hurry. He could feel cold sweat running down his back and chest, and his trembling lips felt bloodless and cold. Although he wanted to get up and go ask for help in the tavern, he knew that he could never climb down the ladder without breaking his neck. He could only lie there, gripping the straw under him, and pray that he wasn't dying. Panic hit him like waves slapping a pier in a storm. He found himself remembering the Dwayoma man who'd taken Jill away, the fellow taunting him, then adding one last insult. "You've got to stop stealing women and horses, or it'll kill you." At the time, Perrin had assumed the fellow meant that some outraged husband would murder him or such like, but now he realized the truth. Something was wrong, very gravely wrong, and he didn't know what it was. Did the Dwayoma man know? Would he help if he did? Not likely, from the hate-filled things the fellow had thrown into his face. In a confused babble, his thoughts went round and round until at last he slept, tumbling into a darkness without dreams. About 2 hours before noon on the morrow, Jill finally got her first view of Dundevery when the barge tied up at the riverside piers about a half-mile to the north. For a long while she stared at the massive walls that curved around the city, rising high above them on its 7 hills. Even from their distance, she could just pick out the roofs of the king's palace. Floating high above the towers and snapping in the wind were tiny flecks of yellow that had to be the cloth of gold banners of the Wyvern throne.
"Quite a sight, isn't it?" Salamander said. "Let's get those horses unloaded and get on our way. Just wait until you see the gates."
The gates were easily 12 feet high and 20 broad, and they were carved all over with panels of key patterns set round with bands of interlace. The iron banding was stamped as well with rows of interwoven spirals and rosettes. Since the walls were a good 20 feet thick, they walked through a sort of tunnel and found yet another set of gates at the other end, just as elaborately decorated as the first. Beyond them was a wide public space, planted with oak trees around a central fountain, where a marble wyvern rose from the spray. From this park, the narrow streets unwound, spiralling through the houses and up the hills, or twisting down through shops and taverns toward the lake to the west. Everywhere Jill looked, she saw people hurrying about on some business or other, or here and there the splendidly dressed riders of the king's own guard. Salamander led her to the inn he had in mind, a three-story broch rising in the midst of a grassy garden. She looked at the roof, covered with